Today's program has been brought to you by Cider Week New York City, happening November 6th through 15th, 2015. For more information, check out ciderweeknyc.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking store located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes. Follow me on Instagram and Twitter, at Feast Your Ears. Today in the studio, joining me, is Matt Dellinger. Matt is a writer, a resident of the borough of Brooklyn, like myself, and is interested in a lot of history stuff. Thanks for joining me today, Matt.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here.
Can you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about, you know, what you do? What do you tell people you do if you meet them and they say, what do you do,
Matt? Oh, it's very complicated. the short answer is I'm a writer, and I do big digital archives for magazines. So most of my time and income comes from helping people with their big archives. But I've written a book, and I'm working on another one, and that kind of occupies most of my passion time and bandwidth. Yeah,
great. I found you, Kristen, who's my producer, found you because we were looking for interesting people. You seem pretty interesting.
Well, thanks.
But it was through a piece that you wrote for The Times about being a Civil War reenactor. You had written about becoming interested in reenacting events, and now that's something you do regularly, correct?
Yeah, I kind of entered into reenacting as a form of research. About 10 years ago or so, I met a group of reenactors at an event in the Greenwood Cemetery. They were rededicating the monument there to Civil War soldiers. And there were a group of reenactors from the Brooklyn 14th, and they had interesting uniforms. They had red pants instead of blue. They kind of had interesting jackets with a lot of brass buttons on them. And I struck up a conversation with a few of these reenactors, and just the story of the regiment and the way these guys talked about it was infectious. And I kind of went home and Googled and started reading and, you know, then looked outside and the sun was going down, and I had spent all day basically reading about this regiment. And, you know, fast forward a couple of years and I set out to write a book about them. And so I called them back up and said, you know, I still have the guy's emails and phone numbers, and said, you know, I want to join you. I want to put the uniform on and go out with you. And, I wasn't sure how I'd like it, but it turns out to be a lot of fun. It's basically, you know, camping, but with guns, and
I've done a lot of camping with guns.
So yeah,
and not wearing red.
That's right.
Pants,
for a lot of people, there's no distinction there. Mm-hmm. But you know, and the history element of it's kind of fun. I mean, I know a lot of people think of it as a kind of a hokey / dorky hobby, and I'm sure it is to some degree. But at the same time, there's no replacement for it. I don't know how I would have gained kind of the category of knowledge I have if I hadn't tried to do it myself.
Sure. I mean, it seems to me to be something, in fact, valuable, right? That we, as a country, are, you know, we're in a war. We've been in a war for a really long time, but none of us have any real connection to that unless you are a soldier who served or have family who's a soldier who served. But the Civil War was the last war that actually happened on our soil.
Yeah.
And there's nobody alive who remembers that actually happening, who remembers their family shipping off to actually go fight other members of our country.
That's right. And, you know, it wasn't long after the Civil War when you had, you know, machine guns and airplanes and things that made war a lot more mechanized. And so this was kind of the last, you know, marching for miles. You know, other wars involved marching, obviously, but there was, you know, just, it's something you can wrap your head around. It's, I mean, organic's not the right word, but it has that same sort of down-home feel, the Civil sure. War. It's handmade in many ways. Everything that a soldier used to fight, he carried on his back.
Right. When you're involved in the specific reenactments, do they take place in the original locations of the battles? And I guess, you know, as a member of the Brooklyn 14th, you know, are you playing yourself, Matt Dellinger, when you are doing the reenactment, or are you playing an actual soldier who was in the regiment?
Well, the level of kind of fidelity to reality differs from event to event. Some events are very much living history events where we're basically there. We set up a camp. We're in uniform. And our main job is to engage with the modern public and have these kind of conversations where, you know, we don't pretend to not know what they're talking about if they talk about the state of Alaska or something. what's Alaska? You know, right. we're very comfortable mingling centuries and the past and the present. And so, but there are events where it is, you know, this is the 150th Gettysburg, so we're going to do, it's going to be multiple days, and the last thing's going to be Pickett's charge, and the first thing's going to be the railroad cut, and, you know, we try to have the sequence of events match what actually happened.
Do the folks who are reenacting on the Confederate side or rebel side, you know, in these battles or in the reenacting of the war, do they get bummed out? I mean, they're playing a losing side.
Not always, though. I mean, you know, the first reenactment of each 5-year cycle is Bull Run, and you know, the Confederates did pretty well at Bull Run, and it was the Union that ran back to Washington, literally. But there's a joke we joke about Revlar instead of Kevlar, that, you know, we'll be shooting and shooting and shooting and no one's falling down. And, you know, there's moments where it doesn't quite live up to reality. There's maybe not quite as many casualties as you would expect given the historical circumstances. But, I mean, again, we all know that it's the verb we use about reenacting is play. You know,
right.
They're not playing nice. You know, we know it's play. It's right. Not. And you asked about do you portray anyone? Basically, we all adopt soldiers. We're encouraged to pick someone from the company of our regiment and get to know as much about them as possible and research them. Obviously, I'm researching the whole regiment. So, but I kind of by the time I joined, I was a couple years ago. A lot of the people who had started out at the very beginning and had made it through the whole 3 years of their engagement were taken. So I had a choice between choosing someone who was either died or wounded or captured very early, or someone who started late. And I chose someone who started late. I thought that would be an interesting, you know, what if you came into this war in the middle? And there was a group of 1862 recruits that joined right before Antietam. And if you can imagine kind of, you know, coming into the Civil War and having that be your welcome. It was a very, very bloody battle. The Brooklyn 14th in particular sustained many casualties, and a lot of the guys who had just arrived as new recruits were actually got into the fight, even though they hadn't been fully trained and probably weren't expected to. So anyway, it's you adopt a soldier just enough to kind of have an interesting personal perspective on the events that the regiment went through. But no, we don't, you know, I don't answer to John Boyce, who's the guy's name.
Right. And so you talk about how it becomes, you know, it's about camping. And so you're camping and sleeping in, I assume, period appropriate tents and sleeping facilities. What about cooking?
Well, cooking, we've gotten, there have been periods where we're into cooking and periods where we're not into cooking. Generally, though, the food situation at an event follows, you know, I was talking about the range of authenticity. We have this kind of home field, whatever, in Long Island at Old Bethpage Village Restoration. And we have a good relationship with them, and we can just kind of go. And if there's four of us that want to camp and sit around the fire and set up our tents and march around, we can. sometimes there's, you know, at dinner time, we hop in our cars and we drive to McDonald's and
in uniform.
Yeah. And we stand in line at McDonald's wearing our uniforms. That's obviously not very authentic. In other cases, you know, at the most recent event, I went to the Paisano Meat Market on Smith Street right by my house, and I bought some wild game sausages that I thought would be, you know, I'm sure not exactly period correct, but close enough. Venison and rabbit and wild boar and what was the fourth one? I'll think of it. Duck. Hmm. And yeah, cooked them. You know, we had a campfire and you kind of carve out a spot and rake over some coals and put down a skillet. And as the light's going away, you know, it's challenging circumstances. But it's to me, it's very fun to kind of eat in that, I guess it would be called paleo or primal, some kind of very basic way where you're not using a ton of spices or a ton of oil or even, you know, intricate cooking equipment. You're basically just applying heat to food and eating it. If that. So a lot of times when I go shopping for an event, I'll just go and get, you know, if I can find green beans with the stems still on and kind of multiple of them stuck together, that's perfect for the kind of feel that I'm looking for at an event. And I actually have these muslin sacks, these unbleached muslin sacks, and you can basically throw anything you want in there and it'll look authentic when you, yeah, so... Even
for,
if it's,
for how it was being carried,
yeah.
In the field.
So you throw those beans, you take them out of the plastic bag, you put them in that bag, or you buy some almonds, and I'm not sure almonds were that prevalent in North America back then, but
doubtful. I think.
But you know, peanuts,
sure,
perhaps
peanuts for sure.
Anyway,
pecans,
yeah. So it's again, it's not a we don't do the research into the food quite as much as we do the battle. Aspects of things, or the uniforms in particular, are very, very well researched.
So you mentioned the uniforms, you mentioned the red pants, but you know, at least my experience learning about the Civil War, the North was blue.
Mm-hmm.
So where do the red pants come from and fit in?
Well, the so right before the Civil War, there wasn't a very big army in the U.S. There wasn't a big standing army like we have now. You had a lot of local militias that were a lot more like the National Guard, but even still also kind of like the Marat Shriners or the, you know, the Moose Lodge or something. It was kind of a, you know, community organization that was slightly militarized. It was a militia. It was formed by the state of New York. It was, you reported up to a state commander, but Brooklyn had a number of these militias. I mean, 14 of them, I guess, at least, and each of them could choose their own uniform. So the Brooklyn 14th had a uniform made that was inspired by this French uniform worn by the Chasseurs, this kind of light infantry group. And the, you know, the jackets, a lot of people mistake us for Zouaves, which is a type of soldier where they had the fez and a really short jacket and balloony kind
and the Zouaves,
of pantaloons.
As I understand it, were related actually to the fire department.
That's right. There's
well.
A New York regiment of fire Zouaves,
yeah.
That had the red pants. And those, they're famous. The Brooklyn 14th are less famous. I hope to change that. But their pants were regular straight pants, and the jacket was not quite as cartoonish. It was a little more normal. But they had these uniforms designed and made. And at Bull Run, which I mentioned before, the early battle in the war, Bull Run was a mess. I mean, neither of these armies was really prepared to fight at all, let alone in a major engagement. And they didn't have time to standardize the uniforms. All these people were Americans. So they, you know, it wasn't obvious that the North was going to be blue and the South was going to be gray. And so there were... Northerners wearing gray, there were Southerners wearing blue, there were, you know, and people were shooting at the wrong side. And at that battle, Stonewall Jackson, when the Brooklyn 14th were doing some repeated charging of his position, apparently said, it's quoted as saying, "Here come those red-legged devils again." And so red-legged devil is the kind of worn with a badge of honor, worn with pride as a nickname for the Brooklyn 14th. And sort of from that moment forward, they resisted every attempt to bring them into the normal Union Army. So they tried to say, "You're not the Brooklyn 14th. We're going to call you the 84th New York. We're reorganizing the number system." And they said, no, we're not 84th New York, we're 14th Brooklyn. They fought and finally went all the way up to the Secretary of War, who said, okay, you fought under the Brooklyn 14th, under that flag, we can't change it now. And even the uniforms, they would send them kind of the blue uniforms, the federal issue uniforms, and the guys would wear them, like, to dig trenches. And then when the battle happened, they'd change back into the red pants. So
were they the only regiment in the war that was able to keep their locale in their name? I mean, you talk
great
talk
question
about
yes
organized.
They were the only regiment that really is known as a by a city designation, not a state designation. There were other prevalent nicknames on both sides.
And at that time, Brooklyn wasn't even, I mean, Brooklyn was its own city still.
It was its own city.
New York City had not been organized into the five boroughs yet.
That's right. Until the 1890s, it was a separate city and a rival city of New York.
Sure.
Yeah.
I have a lot of experience with the history of firefighting in New York. My father is a firefighter
no
and
kidding.
Collects antique firefighting things. So the fire zoavs are something I've learned about and seen a little bit about.
I should put on the uniform, come out sometime.
Yeah, for sure. But I'm interested to know, you know, there have been lots of histories written of the fire department of the city. There was a famous one written in the late 19th century that listed every single firehouse because they were all volunteers initially.
Yeah.
There was a book written about Brooklyn, and then there was one written about New York focused on Manhattan. And, you know, they go through and list all of the guys who were in these firehouses, but they all had other jobs.
Right.
Right. And so
exactly.
There's all of the, you know, one guy's a tinker and one guy's a tinsmith and one guy's a blacksmith and the other guy's a butcher and, you know, all of these different jobs, and they all happen to also be firefighters. Is that the same thing with the Civil War?
Absolutely. Yeah. These militia was not a full-time job at all. These guys were bankers or they were pipe fitters at the Navy Yard or I think the first colonel at Bull Run was a guy named Alfred Wood who was captured at that battle. Eventually returned in a prison swap and became mayor of Brooklyn. So he was mayor of Brooklyn later in the war, and the Edward Fowler became the for those of you listening or yet to listen who live in Fort Greene, there's that triangular park right by Smoke Joint and Frank's and near BAM. The guy in uniform, the statue in that triangle, is Colonel Fowler of the 14th Brooklyn. And he, after the war, was an accountant, you know, and he lived out his days in Brooklyn, having led this heroic regiment. And in those days, you didn't have, like, you know, retired military people going into the defense business. You probably did, but Edwin Fowler just became an accountant. People went back to their everyday lives in large part. And, that's part of what the story I want to tell and why it's so much harder to research. I mean, you can tell many times the story of the Brooklyn 14th and their actions in battle have been told and compiled and monuments built to them. And but what about these individual people? That's what I'm kind of fascinated by and want to dig into. You know, what happened? You know, there's a guy named Alfred Cranston, and the Brooklyn Historical Society has a lot of the family papers. And there's some picture of him as an old man with a white mustache with a bicycle. The bicycle didn't exist during the Civil War. It was kind of popularized in the late 1800s, 1880s. So these guys, you know, imagine these guys, they fought in the Civil War and they watched Brooklyn change so dramatically. They watched the Brooklyn Bridge get built. They watched streetcars come. They watched the bicycle happen. And all this stuff that kind of are the elements of our modern Brooklyn really kind of started back then. And it was a time of great change when Brooklyn went from a farming community, a rural community, and really became a city in its own right and then part of New York. And these guys watched it happen. The reason I chose the guy I did, John Boyce, is because he lived into the 1920s. I found an article from – they used to get together every year in a reunion in Fort Greene Park, which is where they had first formed up as a regiment and recruiting them off to war. And in, I think, 1926 or something, he was one of the last 14 members of the Brooklyn 14th. So I'm hoping he left behind an interesting life
yeah.
that I can, you know, poke around into. That was my hope.
Nice. Yeah, I look forward to reading that when it's written. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the Brooklyn 14th, and then we'll talk about some other eating and traveling.
Great.
Cider Week helps to bring profitability to local orchards while reviving heirloom apple varieties by cultivating awareness of craft cider. Cider Week connects cider makers from New York State and select pioneering guest cideries outside the state to buyers from top restaurants, bars, and retail shops across New York City. Those culinary tastemakers, in turn, help increase consumer awareness of cider's pleasures by hosting public events, tastings, dinners, classes, and pairings that build appreciation and demand for regional ciders.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, and with me today is writer Matt Dellinger. Before the break, we were talking about Matt's experiences doing Civil War reenacting with the 14th Brooklyn Regiment. And I'd like to turn the conversation now to some of your other work, Matt. Mm-hmm. You wrote a book about Interstate 69, which has been called the NAFTA Highway. It's a highway that remains unfinished that was planned to go from Canada to Mexico.
Right, that's right.
What part of it is complete?
Well, it's under construction in Indiana. A portion that goes from Port Huron, Michigan, in a big arc around Detroit and down into Indianapolis, Indiana, my hometown, was part of the original interstate system. And the plan was to extend it south to Evansville, Indiana, kind of along western Kentucky, down into Memphis and western Tennessee, and then into the Mississippi Delta, cutting across corners of Arkansas and Louisiana into East Texas and around Houston and then down the Rio Grande Valley. It's a very long planned highway. The Texas portions are kind of being built just as Texas upgrades its state highways and U.S. highways.
So the roadbeds are already there. It's just not part of
In their case, yeah. They were like, look, we have this road from Houston to Brownsville. We'll just make it an interstate, you know, close off the cross sections and everything. The places that are trying to build, the places that are the slowest and may never be completed are bridges. So they have to get over the Ohio River south of Evansville, and they have to get over the Mississippi River somewhere between Mississippi and Arkansas. There's a spot that's planned, but it's kind of connecting two rural communities, and there's not a lot of economic activity, and they just put a new bridge at Greenville. So it's kind of, anyway, we're in the weeds. But it's each state has to handle its piece. There
sure.
is no more federal interstate program. So what that means is some states have money. Some states have, the highway promoters have more political influence than in other states. So it's being kind of built piecemeal in Indiana and Mississippi and Tennessee. It's under construction, but definitely not in, Arkansas.
Do you think it will be completed someday, or is this destined to be a sort of project like the Lower Manhattan Expressway?
I bet you in 20 years there's a way to drive on some road called I-69 from Canada to Mexico. Whether it will follow the route that was intended, I don't know. But they might, the way that they do, they kind of assign one interstate two numbers, just to get from here to there. They might do that. This book, I took 7 years. I like to research. I like to take my time working on a book, much to my chagrin of my agent and readers. But, reporting the I-69 book was just so much fun. I'm from Indianapolis. My dad moved to Houston, and I was down in the Mississippi Delta writing for the Oxford American, 15 years ago. And those three places were just really different and really interesting, and I kind of got this taste in my mouth for rural America or, small town America, the kind of the places nobody ever goes. It's so great to be a journalist because you can just roll into a small town and email the mayor or the mayor's office or whatever, and that person, you know, the mayor will spend all day with you, driving around town with you, pointing out everything, you know, you want to tour that factory? Okay. And he makes a phone call and you're touring a, you know, Toyota plant or whatever it is. It's just kind of like having this backstage access to an America that people don't really think about that often. And it was great fun and there was great food.
Yeah, I mean, the food in those kinds of places, I've driven cross-country a number of times and a lot of time spent on the highway, but always tried to make time to get off the highway as much as possible.
Yeah, there's an art to that, kind of knowing which exit is going to have the non-chain.
You know,
because they can't always afford the sign on the blue food sign coming towards the exit, but you're like, I bet this one, I don't know, this exit's got something, and you get off.
The most memorable one that I ever went to was in New Mexico. There was a cafe called Lena's.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just a great breakfast there that I remember to this day. I don't even know if it's still there. I have no idea what town it was in.
In New Mexico.
Yeah.
Lena's. Sounds delicious.
It was.
What did you eat? Do you remember what you ate?
Some version of a sort of like Southwest, you know, eggs.
Oh, yeah. Scramble kind of thing. Yeah, there was. I remember being introduced by, during the reporting of this book, introduced in Austin, Texas, to migas, the kind of thing where you crumble up tortillas and put them into scrambled eggs. That place is gone now. It's like a big condo building. But my favorite place, there's a place in Memphis, Tennessee, called the Little Tea Shop. And I randomly just went in there one day, just thinking, oh, this looks cute, interesting. And the address was 69 at 69 Monroe Street. And I thought, oh, all right, fine, I'll eat here. And I've been going there now regularly for ever since, which is probably 10 years. It's run by this woman, Suher Lauk, and she and her late husband, Jimmy, bought the place, you know, decades ago. And they're just these fixtures in downtown Memphis. All of the politicians and lawyers and judges and journalists kind of come there for lunch and talk. And it's only open for lunch. It's open from 11 a.m., I think, to 2 p.m. during the week, 5 days. That's it. And yet it's crowded. The food is amazing. You get corn sticks, which are these cornbread in the shape of a stick. My stomach's actually growling talking about
tea
shop.
But let's go to Memphis. I'm ready for lunch.
But she's Palestinian and they don't use pork. So it's
sure.
a lot of, you know, it's interesting.
And
because,
in Memphis, right?
Yeah, exactly. Most places in Memphis, you just, you can't get away from pork. It's in the water. but she makes turnip greens with no pork and they're just delicious. They're the best turnip greens in the city. I don't know.
I lived for a summer, when I was in college in Indianola, Iowa.
Oh.
Which is on I-35 south of Des Moines.
Okay.
And it was a small town that had been, you know, because it was off the highway, had lots of chains. There was a Cracker Barrel and Pizza
right.
Hut and Taco Bell and all those things. But there were two independent restaurants in town. One was like white tablecloth and fancy because there was an opera company. That's what I was there to do. There was a university there that in the summer had an opera company. So for the well-heeled opera patrons, there was a white tablecloth, cloth napkin kind of place. The other independent place in town was where all of the soy and pork farmers hung out. And it was just a like lunch counter cafe.
Oh, yeah.
And every single one, there were hooks on the wall, and every single regular had a coffee cup.
Oh, wow.
Hanging on the wall that when they came in the morning, that was it. And what was playing on the radio every time I went there. 2-3 times a week probably for breakfast. Every time I went, what was playing on the radio was like the Farm Report. It was about what the pork and soybean futures were.
That's fantastic.
And everybody sitting around talking. And their specialty, which was not, I will say, not gastronomically wonderful, but I do remember it very specifically, was beer cheese soup. That was on the menu all the time.
That sounds very Iowa.
Yeah.
That sounds very Midwestern.
It's very, really heavy in the middle of July when it's like 90 degrees out to eat a bowl of beer cheese soup. But
yeah, you're reminding me of a place in Memphis where I was taken for breakfast one time. It's on President Island, which is this industrial island where all the petrochemical and just shipping and stuff happens. And yeah, there's a place where, I mean, until recently, might still even be true in some places, there were smoking sections in restaurants still in Memphis. Or you know, or a non-smoking section, which is one table near the bathrooms or something. But yeah, you just, the number of pickup trucks in the parking lot tells you
that this, sure,
you know, you're going to eat good food for cheap.
That's a good indicator. When I've been on the road, we always look for cop cars.
Yeah, there you go.
Look for like the local police and where they're eating lunch. That's how I discovered a place called Daddy D's, which is still there in Atlanta. Outside downtown Atlanta, there's a barbecue place called Daddy D's that I first ate at about 13 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
Happened to be in Atlanta, driving down the road, hungry. Saw three cop cars and the pickup truck parked in this ramshackle, you know, painted plywood place.
Yeah.
Not unlike some of the aesthetics of Roberta's, where we are right now.
Exactly, the shipping container.
I've been there many times since. I've brought out-of-town guests from Japan, who I happen to see in Atlanta there. And
this was an idea. Maybe you and I can start a business doing this. I thought to myself, especially working on this book, like, I could start a business where I take, like, New Yorkers, people who've never been west of the Hudson River, and it's like a safari. Like, we're gonna go to Tennessee or in Indiana, and I'm gonna show you all the three good places, you know, that kind of thing.
I think there's definitely something there. I think that business model with the internet is a little tougher, right? Because the internet has changed our ability to look at and identify these sort of cool.
I guess that's right.
Out there.
I guess Yelp has stolen my thunder.
But I do think it is an interesting idea to take people on that kind of experience of I've done the work of finding this place. I got off at exit 32 and turned left instead of right. And like,
yeah, I get so sad about people who go to Memphis and they hang out on Beale Street and they go to the three museums and then they fly home and they go, oh, well, all right.
Yeah.
If you care about Memphis, I guess it's a cool place. If you care about Elvis.
Yeah.
But there's just so much more to it.
In your research, for the book, was there anywhere that you went where you felt like the highway was really going to improve things for people there, that it was really going to be like a boon? I mean, you talk about these areas in very rural Mississippi.
Yes.
and Arkansas, where they need to build a bridge. And I mean, looking at, like, you know, there's a number of bridges going up around us. There's a new Kosciuszko Bridge, and I don't even know what the price tag is on that. There's a new Tappan Zee Bridge that's in the billions of dollars.
Yeah.
That we're building. And, you know, obviously we're talking about the affluent Northeast when we talk about those.
Well, I mean, I could talk for a long time about this. To boil it down, I mean, the book did not take a position. The book was not pro-highway. The book was not anti-highway. There are places that had a legitimate expectation of economic development to come out of the building of the highway. The Mississippi Delta, though, you know, a lot of the economic development people there told me in all candor that, like, you know, the highway is just one part of it. We don't have a very well-educated workforce here. We don't have a very good reputation here. We don't have, you know, the farther you get from Memphis, the farther you, or Jackson, the farther you get from a place people want to live near. I mean, people, there's kind of this urbanization happening. So I think to some degree, highway as economic development tool is an old way of thinking. On the other hand, there are without a doubt places that, you know, I don't know. I again took a very historical look in the writing of this book, and you know, you go to some of these towns, and the reason they exist in the first place is because they were on a railroad. A train needed to stop and do whatever, get more coal,
get water,
more water, yeah, every 20 miles or something. So if you wanted a rail line from Indianapolis to the Ohio River, you needed a town every 20 minutes, every whatever, every so often. And that meant there was a grain elevator. That meant there was some place to eat. There were probably a smattering of houses. There was at least a village. And when the interstates replaced the railroad as the vital kind of economic bloodstream of the country, a lot of it, freight railroad is still very important to a lot of industries. But for the main kind of, you know, UPS and stuff like that, a lot of these towns have dried up. So you know, it's tough to argue with a person who grew up in a town and is now 50 years old and the mayor or the economic development chief, and who says, you know, we've got to fight for this town to survive. My heart goes out to them. But
right.
Yeah. But then if you pull back 1,000 feet, you know, kind of a a view from the moon and you just think, oh, well, the nation's reorganizing itself yet again.
Right.
You know, the Great March continues.
Perhaps you could take those people on a safari to Manhattan. You know, you could have them go back and forth.
Yeah, perhaps you'd be more comfortable in a efficiency apartment in Bushwick.
Probably not. Well, just to finish up here, I'd like to bring it back to food.
Yes.
I understand that at least twice a year you make gumbo. That you're known for. Can you give us sort of a rough layout of your gumbo recipe, and also why gumbo?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I used to throw I'm big into annual events, apparently, but I used to have a Super Bowl party at my apartment when I had a roommate that I went to college with, and we would just make chili every year. And then one year, a vegetarian was coming, so, we have to make a vegetarian chili. And then another year, you know, you just get bored, so you're like, let's try a white bean something something.
Sounds very much like my wife and I have a New Year's Day chili party every year.
There you go, yeah.
And we're on, like, 14 years or something coming up. So, I mean, like, very similar. You know,
New Year's Day is a great time for this because, you know, everyone's home and needing good comfort food.
Hungover.
But then one year, when the Super Bowl was in New Orleans, whatever year that was in the early 2000s, you know, we thought, oh, well, the Super Bowl's in New Orleans, we'll make gumbo. And I had this recipe in a big, I think it's literally called the Big Book of Soups and Stews or something like that. And I was setting out to make duck gumbo. And I went to Chinatown and bought a duck. Like, I'd seen them hanging in windows. It wasn't a Peking duck. It was a raw duck. But I brought it home, and a friend of mine who happened to be there, kind of to sous chef for me, was like, oh, duck fat, that's perfect. You're going to make the roux with the duck fat. I said, am I? Oh, I guess I am. And then looked up how to do that. And so, yeah, you just kind of all from scratch, take the skin off the duck, sizzle the skin, get the duck fat, make a roux. It takes a very long time. And then the vegetables go in. And I put the duck meat in, and I put andouille sausage in, and I put shrimp and oysters. And one year I put in nutria. Do you know what a nutria is?
Yes, I do. I've never eaten it. I was invited once to go nutria hunting, but I didn't actually go.
Oh, that sounds like more fun than nutria eating. But there was actually a friend.
For those of you listening who don't know what a nutria is a large rodent.
A swamp rodent.
Yeah, that lives down in the Mississippi Delta area.
It was introduced to Louisiana by the guy who invented Tabasco sauce.
Oh, I did not know that.
Who brought them over from France to grow them for fur. And then he decided to get out of that business.
Nobody wanted rat fur coats. They weren't really popular,
I guess. He released them into the wild, thinking, well, the gators will get them. And the rest is history. Now it's an infestation. So a friend of mine who was a Fox News producer said, you know, for the show, we want to do a story about nutria and how Louisiana's trying to get people to eat these and kill and eat these things. You'll eat anything. Will you cook with this thing and then talk to us? And I said, well, sure. And actually it was in the freezer at the New Yorker for a long time, because that's where she had handed it off to me. So I brought it home and put it in the gumbo. And it was pretty mediocre.
Yeah, well, it sounds good. I'm gonna have to check out and make some duck
gumbo. Yeah, I'll
send
you some tips.
Great. Well, thank you, Matt. I think we're pretty much out of time here, but I appreciate you taking your time out of your Wednesday to come down to the studio and hang out. Thank you for listening this week to Feast Your Ears. Big thank you to Kristen Baylor, my producer, and Liz Smith, who engineers this show every Wednesday. And if you have a chance, please take a moment to like the show on Facebook and iTunes, and follow me on Instagram. Talk to you next week. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.